This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You're listening to The Lines Between Us.
I believe we can keep the promise of our founding. The idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you look like, or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white, or Hispanic, or Asian, or Native American, or young or old, or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
President Barack Obama speaking Tuesday night, relishing his election to a second term in office. His victory was decisive, but the campaign that led to it was contentious. It showed sharp lines splitting the electorate and hints of racism, sometimes not subtle. We wanted to find out, what role did race play in this election as compared to 2008? What does the president's victory tell us about how our society is changing? Are the lines moving? And what has this president done to bridge divides? Joining me now to discuss this is Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let me put the question to you. What role did race play in this election?
So when we talk about the role race plays, it's important to talk about some of the ways it could work. So we can have a candidate himself or herself be demonized using racial language, you know, depicting that person as being not American, using the language of race implicitly or explicitly. His supporters can be demonized in the same way. And then there are a series of structural decisions that people in the party can use to make participation much more difficult for non-white populations in this case. And what we see in this election, in contradistinction to 2008, is a combination of all three. That is, there are a number of ways we can talk about how Romney himself would racially demonize Barack Obama, referring to his ideas as being illegitimate or himself as being kind of not American, with his race being a factor in that. We can also point to ways that Romney demonized the populations, the non-white populations that were more likely to support Obama. So we can point to his speech, for example, at the NAACP. We can also point to the private speech he gave about the 47%. And then finally, we can point to a number of different ways that the Republican Party sought to dampen the non-white vote by the use of voter suppression tactics.
What about the election results?
It appears as if Romney's tactics, so the way that race works is to the extent that we could talk about this as a tactic that was used on purpose, the idea was to drive white voters to Romney and away from Obama in a way that would give Romney the victory. And it worked. Romney received a higher percentage of the white vote than McCain did. But the challenge is they underestimated how large that non-white vote was. And their voter suppression tactics appear to have backfired on them. So, yes, he received a higher percentage of the white vote, but he still ended up losing the Electoral College by a sizable margin. And he lost the popular vote by a slim margin, but by still a sizable one.
That's Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the lines between us in the 2012 electorate. Barack Obama is the first president since Franklin Roosevelt to be elected with unemployment this high.
Yeah.
I think it was 14% the first time FDR was reelected. And obviously FDR is famous for setting the United States on a path of big government with the New Deal. So does this vote in 2012 indicate a desire on the public's part to change the role of government?
Well, if you look at this in combination with a state referenda, I think it does. I'm not sure whether Obama will take the opportunity as offered for him to do that. But if you, for example, look at California, California has been hamstrung by Proposition 13, a proposition passed over 30 years ago that made it very, 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 very difficult for them to raise taxes. It required a supermajority for them to raise taxes. For the first time, they actually have that supermajority, and at least one tax increase referenda actually passed. right? And then if you add that to the more cultural stuff about the about either same-sex marriage here in Maryland or marijuana laws, marijuana legalization laws in states like Colorado, it does point to increased support for the use of government in progressive ends.
Equality, specifically income inequality. What has President Obama done to address income inequality in the U.S.? And what has he not done that he should have done?
Okay, so what he has done with the stimulus package, he's dampened the effect of a bad economy on a segment of the population. It was hitting a number of Americans, really, 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 really hard. And then that stimulus package doesn't make it a lot better, but it keeps it from getting a lot worse, mm-hmm. right? That's one thing he's done. The other thing he's done is Obamacare, to the extent that people are losing, are being hit by the economy in part because of health issues, that Obamacare goes a little bit of the way. And then with foreclosure relief, at least some people have received foreclosure relief as a result of Obama's policies. But he hasn't gone far enough with these policies. And he hasn't even, now one could argue that the reason he hasn't gone far enough in these policies is because Republican obstructionism. Even to the extent that you can argue that's the case, what you don't really see over the past four years is a consistent narrative saying that inequality is a bad thing for all Americans and that this isn't an American value. And you haven't seen a persistent narrative saying that we should actively use government to deal with, to help the lives of people hardest hit. We've seen that a little bit, but it hasn't been consistent enough. In a number of cases, he's reproduced the conservative Republican line about the role of government and about the role of the economy. So the thing that jumps immediately to mind is when he talked about how governments are like families. Everybody has to, everybody has to tighten their budget. No, governments aren't like families. Like, I can't create my own currency. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that those of us on the liberal to left end, we want him to be far more aggressive domestically on those issues.
He did not campaign on income inequality.
Well, he talked about it a little bit, but you didn't hear the words poverty at all. When Romney talked about the 47%, at the end of the second debate, Obama brought it back up. And he talked about inequality a little bit in his victory speech, but he just hasn't been aggressive enough. As good, as powerful a speechmaker as Obama is as a campaigner, as we see in that victory speech, as we saw in 2008, we didn't see that at all during his 4 years when he's trying to govern.
So do you expect a push to address income inequality in the second term?
Not from Obama, not without pressure. I think that to the extent we deal with inequality, it's going to come from kind of an Occupy Wall Street 2.0. That is something that's not solely about symbolically occupying spaces so people can visibly visibly see inequality in certain ways. It's going to come from people working in communities like Baltimore and Detroit and St. Louis and Pittsburgh and Gary, actively using a series of traditional and non-traditional political means to put inequality back on the radar. And those movements at a local level will then bubble up and then give the president the ability, if he wants to take it, give him the ability and the opportunity to speak to these issues pretty forcefully.
Lester Spence, thank you for talking to us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate your work.
Lester Spence is Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We have more information and more of this interview at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Kess. Next up, we keep trying to understand some of the lines between us. Now that same-sex marriage is legal, where does the LGBT community go from here? Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, the Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. Maryland voters approved same-sex marriage at the ballot box on Tuesday, marking a shift in public opinion that's been occurring over the last several years. Same-sex marriage had been defeated 32 times by voters across the country prior to Tuesday night. Now, Maryland will join 8 other states and the District of Columbia in allowing same-sex marriage. We wondered what this means moving forward for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, community. Carrie Evans is the executive director of Equality Maryland, an advocacy group that worked to pass the same-sex marriage referendum. Carrie, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Tom.
Dana Beyer is the executive director of Gender Rights Maryland, a transgender rights advocacy group. And Dana, good to see you as well.
Same here.
So, Carrie, passing same-sex marriage has been your, you know, central focus for a long time. How do your priorities shift now that that fight has been won?
Well, I mean, our priorities, although it has been marriage, has also been since 2001 transgender equality. I mean, in 2001, when we passed the statewide anti-discrimination law that unfortunately had gender identity and expression not included, we have just as hard worked on making sure transgender protections were there as well. So now with marriage, you know, in the finished pile, we can focus on, you know, the other issues that impact our community, you know, health issues and HIV issues and, of course, our kids in school. You know, there's a whole another round of things to work on, and now we can really focus.
And in that round, where does transgender legislation
sit? It's our top priority.
Mm-hmm. And Dana, what's the impact on the transgender community of this, the passage of the same-sex marriage?
Well, in Maryland, it's obviously it's a great event, but I think it's more of an American event than it is a Maryland-specific event. This year has been a tectonic shift in America in general. This year, trans rights came to the fore across America with the 11th Circuit decision coming out of Georgia. The 11th Circuit, probably the most conservative federal circuit in the country, decided that rule that trans people are a protected class under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. One of the most right-wing judges in the country, Bill Pryor, was on that panel. Title VII was expanded in
and
the
Macy
decision.
That's a regulation from the EEOC.
Well, but that's the Title VII was a signal part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which covered sex discrimination as far as employment goes. And that now covers trans and gender nonconforming people, which includes it's a group that's far greater than just the trans community. Mm-hmm. And also this year, we had gender identity sort of removed as a mental illness, which is another huge step forward. So there's been national shifts, not just for marriage equality, but also for trans rights. Moving forward now in Maryland, now that the legislatively most of the gay-specific issues are gone, now there is room for the trans rights for the state to finally do what the federal government has done. We are covered already in half the counties as far as population goes in Maryland now. And I would say roughly 90% at least of the trans population is already covered county-wise in Baltimore City. We're going to be working on Prince George's County in early winter. And then we hope at some point when the Senate president is willing to pass a statewide law.
Mm-hmm. So, Carrie, the trans community has been associated with the lesbian, gay, bisexual community. You're in the initials, you know, LGBT. Mm-hmm. But there is a perception that there is some tension between the trans community and the LGB community. This series is called The Lines Between Us. So let me ask you outright, are there lines between the trans community and others in your coalition? And if so, how do those lines get eliminated?
I think there has been. I mean, you know, both on the national and the state levels, there has been, you know, always a portion of the LGB community who has not embraced transgender equality as a goal of, you know, the LGBT movement. And I think that has changed a lot. You know, we had the Human Rights Campaign under a lot of criticism in years past for not being as supportive of trans equality in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And I think, you know, they were able, when they committed to ensuring that that piece of federal legislation moves forward in an inclusive way, really shifted how people thought about that. That, you know, here we have the largest gay rights organization in the country, including this. And so I think it helped. There's always going to be things that every part of our community doesn't feel like we're addressing, whether, you know, that's are African American, LGBT folks, not feeling like we're focusing enough on race issues, or are, you know, immigrant LGBT folks, you know, not feeling like we can do as much as we want on immigrant issues. So certainly there are lines, but I think, you know, we have very much come together as a coalition of, you know, organizations and people in the marriage movement, which was, you know, at the end, we had over 250 organizations who came together and said, let's do this. And that was, you know, straight, gay, religious, non-religious. And the same thing has to happen, you know, in the trans community, is that that same coalition we formed for marriage has to now pivot to acquiescing around trans equality and taking full advantage of the momentum we have right now.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Carrie Evans is here, the Executive Director of Equality Maryland. Dana Beyer as well, the Executive Director of Gender Rights Maryland. And we're looking at what's next for the LGBT community. So, Dana, what's your take in terms of the relationship between the trans community and the LGBT community?
Well, first, I think it's important to recognize that trans people can be gay, too. Three quarters of the trans community identifies as queer. Gay, bi, queer, pan, you name it. So marriage equality, whereas it's a gay rights issue, I can't see the quotes, is also a trans rights issue because so many of us are in same-sex marriages. Mm-hmm. And that's critical. That sort of gets missed because it muddies the simplistic slogans that are out there. You also have, and I think this is very important to recognize, especially for trans people, too, but it's true everywhere. People are self-interested. We care about what most matters to us. All campaigns are run on this. So it's no question that when the gay community outnumbers the trans community by 8-1 by the latest demographics from Professor Gates at the Williams Institute, that gay issues are going to have more traction in the community than trans issues. That's a given. Most of the money in the LGBT community is given by gay donors. I've been tasked with increasing trans representation on state and national boards. And as Senator-elect Baldwin has said, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So you need to get people around the table to help make those decisions. We have oftentimes token representation at this point. It's got to become more real. There have to be more people. And I believe as we move forward, and as the whole philosophical discussion is now, I believe, shifting from gay versus trans to gender conforming and gender nonconforming, that is a way to bind us together. Because instead of marginalizing those people whose gender expression, gender presentation is more out on the edges, this happened, began in the 70s, we can now bring everybody together, and it's no longer a gay-trans dichotomy. It's simply expanding civil rights, which the EEOC decision does, which the Glenn decision does, which the Schroyer decision did 2 years or 3 years ago in D.C., and encompassing everybody. It's the way American civil rights works, by being the most expansive of the most people.
So, Carrie, why do we need legislation then? We you know, Dana's alluded to various judicial decisions, EEOC regulations. The legislation that you're trying to pass would do what exactly, and why is it needed in Maryland? Is there any federal legislation that already sort of covers the concerns of the LGBT community?
With court cases and EEOC, you know, interpretations, those are all subject to non-permanency. And we don't have a federal law that includes gender identity expression. And, you know, the four counties we have been able to pass these things in are really sort of our most progressive, you know, places in the state. And when you think about the trans folks and gender nonconforming folks who probably need this the most, it's folks in Garrett County, it's folks in, you know, the Eastern Shore that really, you know, we're never going to be able to get a county ordinance passed there. And so, you know, the statewide law ensures that, you know, from Garrett County to the shore, we have protections in housing and public accommodations and employment for all trans and not gender nonconforming folks. And it's permanent. I mean, certainly a future General Assembly could repeal it, but they're not in the business really of doing that. So once you get it in state law, it is usually permanent and therefore interpreted consistently across the state and has, you know, the central, you know, Human Relations Commission of the state enforcing it. And so it helps sort of the most vulnerable in the state who are outside of those four jurisdictions.
And Dana Beyer, you're optimistic then?
Oh, very much so. I mean, now that last year the gender identity bill moved forward, but the Senate president, who basically, as you know, controls much of what goes on in Annapolis, decided that one gay bill was enough. Now, not that the trans bill is a gay bill, but you get that point. Now that that's over with, and now that we made the point that we can win at referendum, I think one of the biggest problems going forward in Maryland is the fact that we are now becoming a little bit too much like California as far as ballot initiatives go. There were more ballot initiatives on the ballot in Montgomery County than there were candidates running for office in total. That's difficult for the population, but it's become so easy now that basically a fifth grade class can petition any bill to referendum that virtually anything, particularly any social justice issue, will end up on the ballot. I think we do need to change the election law. But now this is the last piece of the puzzle, and it is important that the state, we're a federalist system in this country. It's important that Maryland says we can do what the federal courts do and what the EEOC does. But I do want to make it clear that any trans person or gender nonconforming person in the state of Maryland, from the westernmost Garrett County all the way out to the Eastern Shore, if they are discriminated against with respect to employment, they can file a claim with the EEOC. The EEOC offices have been trained in all 50 states, so all trans Americans are covered now.
Dana Beyer is the Executive Director of Gender Rights Maryland. Carrie Evans, the Executive Director of Equality Maryland. Thank you so much to you both. Appreciate it.
No, pleasure. Thank you.
The Transgender Day of Remembrance, an annual event memorializing transgender murder victims, will be held at the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore on November 20th at 6:30. You can find out more about that on our website, as well as more of our conversation. Come to WIPR.org and click on the Maryland Morning link. I'm Tom Hall. You've been listening to The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Coming up, I talk with our movie guys, Jed Dietz and Mike Schragau. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.